Hello and welcome to the latest in the series of RCN Research Reflections. My name is Gordon Hill and I'm the International Lead in the Department of Nursing and Community Health at Glasgow Caledonian University. In these podcasts, we'll be exploring people's experiences of research, roles and responsibilities, and hot topics. We hope you enjoy listening. I'd like to start by introducing our two guests today. Firstly, André Lemay. Before retiring from full-time work, André was a professor of nursing at the University of Southampton. Her long-standing focus on research implementation began in 1986 as a specialist nurse for R&D at a district general hospital in West London, a role created to move research into practice across NHS professional groups, specialties and organisations. Staying close to practice through research, service and development and education, she's since taught, mentored and supervised postgraduate students in knowledge management, knowledge mobilisation, quality improvement, change management and clinical leadership. Secondly, Anne McMahon. Anne was a professional lead in research and innovation at the Royal College of Nursing from 1989 to 2019 and had a huge impact on the research landscape during that time. Anne's doctoral study examined the conditions in which innovations in healthcare may flourish. Anne's commitment is to improve people's health and their experiences of healthcare services through knowledge, innovation, and the empowerment of individuals. Welcome to you both. And we're also joined by Hilal. Hilal is doing his PhD at Glasgow Caledonian University, based in the Department of Nursing and Community Health. So I'd just like to start off by welcoming Hilal, André and Anne. And Hilal, I wonder if you could maybe just tell us a bit about yourself and about your research, please.
Yeah, thank you, Gordon, for this podcast. I'm Hilal Ashidani, a PhD candidate at the School of Health and Life Sciences at Glasgow Caledonian University. I'm currently in my early stages of research journey, and I see my doctoral studies as a valuable opportunity to deepen my knowledge and research skills. My PhD focuses on integration of interprofessional education, IBE, within healthcare education institutions in Oman. And more specifically, I'm exploring the senior academic leaders and faculty members' perceptions and experiences in the implementation of IBE within the healthcare institutions in Oman. And this includes examining the institutional readiness facilitators and barriers and the opportunities for embedding this in the curricula as well. So the goal is to generate evidence-based recommendations that support effective IBE integration, ultimately aiming to enhance collaborative practice among healthcare professionals in Oman. It is a timely and relevant topic, especially in health systems where around the world increasingly recognize the importance of teamwork and collaboration across professions.
Thanks very much for that, Hilal. And I'm right in saying that you in terms of the subject for writing for publication, so you haven't published any of your work yet, is that correct?
Yeah, today is a good experience for me to hear some experiences from our colleagues.
Marvellous. So as we go through the podcast today, the questions that both Hilal and I will be asking will be both to André and Anne. So if you just want to answer them one by one, or if there's only one person, that's absolutely fine as well. So I was just going to kick things off with, and I wonder if we could start with, what are the first steps that should be taken when considering writing for publication?
Will I go first?
Yes.
I think being clear about your purpose is probably a very good place to start. Thinking about who your audience is for the work that you're endeavouring to publish. I think if it's first steps, I would recommend considering mentorship or at the very least having a critical friend. And then perhaps once you've thought these things through, I'd be thinking about potential journals. You know, once I've clarified my purpose and considered who my audience is, that might help me think about, well, where is it best to place this work to reach the audiences I'm interested in, to achieve my purpose. And certainly from our experience, we very much welcomed potential authors to approach editors to sound out whether they felt that what they were endeavouring to achieve was a good fit with the journal. And we would give feedback, encouraging, perhaps suggesting how they might expand or narrow, depending on what they sent us and their perspective. I mean, some kind of précis sending to an editor is a very good start, I think. Yeah, I'll stop there because there's lots of other questions to come. But, yes. Andre, I don't know if you want to add anything. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I suppose the first thing to do, alongside thinking about audience, is to think about what you've got to say. That's critical, isn't it, really? And what your key messages are. And once you've done that, you can decide if you're trying to say too many things in one place, because that's a real challenge for a new writer, to work out what are the key things to say and what doesn't need to be said, or whether or not you need to have two publications to say different things, one about method perhaps and one about results. I think those are probably the key things to add in at this stage to what Anne's already said, which I agree with.
It takes me back, if I may, just a reflection, because I remember when I had the opportunity to present my master's thesis, and it was to a multidisciplinary audience at the Christie Hospital where I was working. And that very, very point about what to put in and what to take out, I hadn't learned that lesson at all. And I said far too much and didn't have that clarity of the key points I was trying to get across. So I think there's so much wisdom from my personal experience of how difficult that can be. And it's just very sound advice to give somebody who's looking to present or indeed to publish their work in other media.
I think it's so important, because I think at that stage people can get so anxious about it. Lots of people who could publish don't, because of this. They don't. That initial step is often the most difficult, even if it then ends up with some rejection before they eventually do get published. I think that first step can be really, really difficult. But I was going to ask you just a wee follow-up to that. How important is it to identify the journal that you're going to be submitting to at the earliest point possible?
It's quite important, because they all have different rules, word limits, scope, readership. So yes, if you can do, target a journal. I mean, you might target one that's particularly about implementation, for instance, or you might target one that's particularly about education. They have a different kind of focus and a different maybe style of writing that's required. So yeah, if you can, but often when you're new to it, you don't know which ones do what, which is why it's so important to do what Anne said and perhaps, you know, write an email to an editor.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Marvellous. So moving on to my next question, I was wondering, because obviously you've been the editors-in-chief of the Journal of Research and Nursing, and there's quite a really useful way of people who perhaps haven't published before to get into writing publications, writing articles. So this may be a bit of a loaded question, but what types of articles are most accessible for beginner authors in journal?
Okay, so one of the things at JRN that we have championed throughout our tenure and inherited from the founding editor was this business of accompanying every paper that we published with a commentary, which I think initially started out as more like publication of a review, but we eventually, over time, we changed the name from review just to make sure there was a clear distinction of what we were aiming to do from the classic peer review of a paper. And the commentary we encourage to be written from the perspective of the author. Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking of a nurse who is in clinical practice, for example, they might read a paper on the cusp of publication and have a perspective about how does this speak to them in their practice? Is it meaningful? What are their reflections on that paper? And we invited commentaries between 500 and 1,000 words. And as I say, it could be from a nurse in practice. It could be from somebody who works in policy, yeah, but perhaps has little experience of publishing or indeed in education. It doesn't matter on the background. And whenever we could, we tried to get a patient perspective as well. So it was really just trying to open up that sense of academic publishing to other voices.
Yeah.
And with our fantastic editorial board, which of course included yourself, Gordon, who was incredibly helpful with this, is we were able to source quite a lot of nurses, either at the early stage of an academic career or indeed in clinical practice, who were maybe pursuing clinical academic careers or aspiring to do so, and saying, would you, with a bit of support, either from yourself, other board members or the editors, would you be interested in writing a commentary, a reflection on a paper? You know, something short, brief, as we say, 500, 1,000 words. So in terms of that question, I think those opportunities, from what we understand, do build confidence in people to think, oh, I published this, I can maybe do a little bit more after it, you know. And some of your colleagues wrote more than one commentary for us, and, you know, they just went from strength to strength. So certainly felt it was a positive thing to do.
Andrea, so once you cut your teeth on a commentary, yeah, and you want to actually get your own research out there and published, I suppose the sort of papers that we would have looked at would depend on the stage of the research that you were at. So if you wanted to really start to publish early, you might sort of begin to think about publishing a protocol. That seems to be quite fashionable now. So you'll have to have written one of those for your PhD or your master's and ethics, those sorts of things. So they should be kind of there and ready. After that, maybe a literature review, if that's the sort of study that you're doing, you might think of publishing. And then I suppose the main and bulk of your publication would be a paper that focused on, you know, background, methods, findings and discussion, very traditional sort of paper. But you can get yourself kind of going, if you like, yeah, by publishing your protocol and also a bit of a background paper if you wanted beforehand. Is that the sort of thing, yeah, that fits with what you're thinking about, Hilal?
Yeah, I think your advice is very essential for us as novice researchers. And for sure, I'm taking this out from this podcast today.
Marvellous. So I'm going to hand over to Hilal. He's got a few questions for you as well.
Yeah, thank you, Gordon. Actually, my questions are based on my experience as a novice researcher, as I said. And those questions are from this perspective. I've heard lots of things about writer's block, imposter syndrome. So how can researchers overcome this, please?
Shall I go again? I've got a couple of thoughts here. And then I certainly know nurses that I've worked with clinically and in other capacities can be the most outstandingly brilliant communicators. And when they try and write, they really, really struggle. So I think one thing that can help is literally to talk and record what you want to say. And it can be something that you can then go on and edit. And the other thing, when you were talking about imposter syndrome and so on, it really goes back, I think, to my earlier answer, that I think having a critical friend, having a mentor, somebody to support you, buddy you, encourage you, and just to remind you that, you know, wherever you are in your journey, if you're a doctoral student, for example, the fact that you've even started that journey puts you in a place where you've got something to say. And that imposter syndrome, it's just that kind of monkey on your shoulder, and you've just got to kind of deal with that. And the more people you surround yourself with who are going to encourage you and support you, the less you'll hear that voice. So that would be my thoughts in relation to that.
Well, writer's block, all have different ways of dealing with that. I actually think it's quite useful to have a paper that's got a framework, which is why a background method research results discussion is useful, because you can then slip information into that framework. You're not really thinking about, well, where do I start? Because you've got that there. I think when I started writing to begin with, I would just sort of write my ideas down. It didn't have to be in any old order. And, you know, because we can use word processing now and very clever techniques, we can juggle them around pretty simply. So start by writing anything. That's the key. The key is not to stare at the screen. It's to get something on there that you can work with and edit. And in fact, I think I probably still do that, actually, even writing an editorial. I'll start out writing a few notes on a piece of paper And then I'll find that miraculously my thoughts have gelled into something completely different. And then I write it and then I jiggle it around and cut and paste it. And whiz, bang, flash, some hours, days, weeks later, there's the kind of polished outcome. And that's a critical thing as well. Don't shortchange yourself on time. Because I think often we think, oh, well, I've only got X number of hours. Well, that's probably very good at inducing panic. So the longer you have, the better. And then you can sort of finish early if you've got extra time and go and have a cup of tea, that sort of thing. So plenty of time. Imposter syndrome. That's tricky, isn't it? I think that is a very difficult thing because I think we perhaps... as supervisors, as more experienced academics, make people feel a bit nervous. Is that what imposter syndrome is? So, yeah, I agree with Anne. A mentor, I mean, supervisors are great. That's what they're there for. If you're doing postgraduate work, being careful to retain ownership of your own work, though. Test things out with your colleagues. You all probably feel the same. But the thing is that to remember that your results are your results, and that's where you hold expertise and power, and you're not really an imposter there, and you're not really an imposter at all. You're giving these results, which you've worked very hard to get, to another community who will then, you know, use them, comment on them or whatever. And that is why, to get over the imposter syndrome barrier, you need to think of the key messages that you're wanting to send in that publication. So that's why I say the first thing you need to do, key messages, then you feel more confident. Key messages can become a framework, then you can start to write. Consult people, and then hopefully they'll be reassuring or they'll give you good advice and the imposter syndrome will kind of go down. So just keep away at it. I'm sure as we all change different, you know, into different specialist areas or levels of expertise or jobs, we all feel a bit kind of nervous. But I've noticed that a lot of people call it this really horrible thing, imposter syndrome. And perhaps we should stop doing that and just say, you know, we have less confidence here, but we've still got good skills to take forward.
So I was wondering, how do you choose the right journal to submit your manuscript to?
I had this fleeting thought of, and I know speed dating, but I don't mean speed dating, but that sense of dating, because I think yes, you want to write to editors, but it's a reciprocal thing, you know. And I just think it's thinking about when, how do you choose the right journal to submit your manuscript to? It is that business of having that communication with different editors to help you collectively make a decision about whether it's a good fit. So I just thinking it's useful to think about, and it maybe builds on the imposter syndrome thing, just think about that sense of it's about a relationship. And it is, there are relationships all the way through the process. And when you think about that, in those relationships, there's power differentials. So just understanding how the whole system works and the whole process. So choosing the right journal to submit your manuscript to, just to reiterate again and reinforce Andre's point about having a clear purpose, having key points, being clear what they are, and then thinking about the purpose of the journal, which ones might be appropriate for you, and then building up those relationships and having those conversations to get a better understanding whether you should expend an awful lot of effort in shaping something specifically for that journal. Or can you get advice very early on that says, actually, you'd be better going over here. Okay. So I think that's a really important question about where do you go, and the earlier you can build that relationship and that understanding of whether it's a good fit or not, the better.
I think it's worth adding in as well, as more and more people publish or want to publish, journals are getting more and more papers to consider, and many journals are using extended processes, if you like, so not just editors in chief, but also associate and assistant editors and topic editors and you name it, whatever editors. So it might be a bit daunting to work out which editor you need to approach, and also it might be a bit daunting when they don't reply. So I would just say, if an editor doesn't reply to you, it's not because they think your ideas are crazy or anything like that, or they're being rude. It's just that they may just be overwhelmed by people and taking other editors' advice in terms of writing to them. So don't let that non-response be a barrier to submitting your paper, because then you should get some response anyway.
And for myself here as well, I wonder if you could tell us about common mistakes that first-time authors make, and how do you avoid them?
Not having key messages. That's an obvious one, isn't it? Just putting down anything and everything that you want to say that you think's relevant. So that is a common mistake, not sifting out what are the key messages, and also what are the right messages to use this journal for, to target those audiences that the journal serves.
I think it's useful at this stage perhaps to just introduce the process. So, you know, when you submit a paper to a journal, certainly with JRN, we didn't, as editors, get to see the paper straight away. It goes through something called an admin checklist. And the reason I'm raising that, because common mistakes first-time authors make is they don't do what it says on the tin. Okay, so reading the guidelines, reading the submission guidelines, using them as a checklist and following them to the letter will make your process much more straightforward. I can't say that, I can't reinforce that loudly enough. I know lots of people get stuck in that first stage of admin checklist, where their paper goes back and forward, and they're having to make lots of changes to it because they haven't read the guidelines, they haven't followed the guidelines, and an editor won't even get to see that. So that's a really quite important message, very, very important that the guidelines are followed. Yeah.
So another common mistake is not reading through your piece particularly well as you submit it, so that there are a lot of kind of, you know, silly errors, grammatical errors, sentences that don't tie up. Very difficult for everybody, but particularly difficult if English is your second language, a second written language. So perhaps getting somebody to check beforehand who's good at editing, a colleague who writes a lot, or somebody whose written language is, first written language is English, is quite useful. Save a lot of time in the long run.
Absolutely, and that's something I always ask someone to do, because I think everyone's got an experience of having looked at a document so often that you don't realise that there's words missing. In your brain, you actually put the missing words in, but it's just really useful to have someone else to read over it before you submit anything, whether that's an essay or whether that's a journal article as well. So.
But really goes back to Andre's earlier point about editors being inundated with papers. Those first impressions really, really matter. So if you take the care to craft and polish your submission, follow the guidelines and craft it beautifully, it's going to have a much more comfortable journey. And if it's pleasing on the eye, then people will read it. And very sound advice.
I was going to say that. This is such good advice. Excellent. So I'm just going to hand back over to Halal. He's got a couple of questions to ask.
One of the things that you've just mentioned is collaboration and peer review, as I understood. So how important is collaboration with other authors, and how can a novice find co-authors or mentors?
Collaboration is tricky, isn't it? You have to ask yourself, first of all, why am I collaborating? Once you've got the answer to that, then I think you'll know whether or not you want to pursue a collaboration or who you want to pursue a collaboration with. Sometimes you need to collaborate because you've been in a multi-person, multidisciplinary project and everybody's taken a part in it, and that's important in terms of recognition. Sometimes you want to collaborate because other people can do different things for you, like the polishing that we're talking about. And now you can actually say what people have done in terms of your manuscript. It's very helpful to be able to see that. Sometimes there's a strange thing about collaboration, which is about a perceived relationship that you have with people. So a student and a supervisor, a student might feel that they should have their supervisor there on the sort of author list. But I'd urge you to ask why that would be the case, what the supervisor is doing there, and what strengths they bring to your publication. Anne, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that's very wise. But it also includes mentorship in the question. How do you find mentors? And that's slightly different, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, somebody can give you that support through the process without necessarily being identified publicly as a collaborator. So I think it's important to tease those things out, understand the difference, and think carefully about each one. Because in asking somebody if they'll be their mentor is not asking them to be your collaborator. It's asking them for the support to help you grow and to be that kind of critical friend. And it would be somebody with the experience to do that, somebody who's been through that process ahead of you, if you like.
Just picking up what you were saying about the potential authors, do you think that there's less of an emphasis on custom and practice now? I mean, it used to always be that the head of department would always get their name last on an article, you know. But I mean, there's much stricter rules now about what constitutes and how you can be an author on a paper. Is that something that you've seen change over the last wee while?
I guess so, yes. I think with the introduction of the credit statement, when you have to say why you're there, you can't just go on it because I'm the head of department. So, yeah, some justification for why you're there, some need to be there. And also, though, you know, you've got the acknowledgement sections as well, where you can acknowledge heads of departments if they've been particularly helpful and supportive, just generally in terms of developing your career, as you can mentors too.
Another question came in mind, if you can explain the peer review process and what to expect as a first-time author.
So the purpose of peer review is, in our case, it was blind peer review. So that means that the author didn't know who was peer reviewing their paper, and the person peer reviewing didn't know who'd authored the paper. So blind peer review. We had two independent, so they were independent of each other, reviewers of every paper submitted. And the rationale for publishing in an academic journal is that the peer review process is designed, its purpose is to endeavour to improve the quality of the paper and to give advice back to both the author and indeed the editors about the quality of the paper. I think what to expect as a first-time author is that you will get constructive feedback from peer review. It's extremely unlikely that a paper gets passed straight through and is published without the request for some consideration of what the reviewers and the editors advise in terms of how the paper might be improved. And that process can happen more than once. So a revised paper can come back in, and if it doesn't hit the correct standard, or there's still concerns or flaws within a paper, then that feedback loop will continue. And I suppose the other thing I'd just add is that comes after the admin checklist that I referred to earlier. So admin checklist, then editor decides if it's a paper they think fits with the journal and it's something they want to pursue, and then they would look for peer reviewers and send the paper out for peer review. And that can take 6 weeks or longer before an author will get that feedback. So it's understanding the process and how long it can take, I think, is important. And as I say, expect constructive feedback. And don't read that necessarily as, don't read it as a negative thing. Understand that it's about trying to encourage and support the quality of the paper and get it to a place where it can be published. Thank you.
So increasingly, journals are going for open peer review as well, where the peer reviewers' comments are open to others to see. So that's also interesting. When you're a novice researcher, maybe to look at a paper that's in a journal like that and see what the reviewers say about that particular paper. And then you can kind of, well, you can learn quite a lot from that, which might help. You know, what things do reviewers pick on particularly in papers? Increasingly, there's much more openness about the whole market, and there are some places where you can still upload a research article before it's peer-reviewed, and then it's peer-reviewed after it's uploaded into that process, and you can see all of that. And I'm not going to give you any names of those because they'll all change by the time the podcast gets out there. So just look out for a changing landscape in peer review. But there should be constructive and helpful comments, which sometimes you may not agree with. And when you reply back to the journals, then you can say, well, I don't agree with that because, and it's very important to do that as well as make changes or agree and thank reviewers.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think from my own experience that there have been times where a reviewer, I have disagreed with them, and it's sometimes difficult to know what to do in those circumstances. Do you make the changes they're suggesting, which you may think may be to the detriment of the overall article, but to go back and give a rationale for why you've said what you've said is important, obviously.
Also, it might be a place where you talk to your mentor, because you may just simply not have enough knowledge to be able to make a decision as a novice researcher. So that's useful to talk to collaborators and mentors about those sort of decisions too, and get their advice.
I was just wondering, we've kind of touched on this a bit in terms of, Andrew, you were saying about giving yourself time to do this, but I guess often the kind of professionals who are going to be submitting these articles, they're largely going to be working full time, either as a clinician or as an academic. So what tips would you have for managing time to actually, you know, get the article written and submitted?
That's a difficult one, isn't it? That's whilst retaining some life-work balance, is it?
Yes.
Because that's often the thing that's sacrificed. It's that balance, isn't it? So, you know, I think being careful about, again, what it is you want to publish. What are the key messages? Don't write more papers than you need to, would be my advice. To do all the things that Anne's also talked about. Look at the scope and the fit and make sure you're not running after things that just are impossible. So real proper advice, think about what you're doing and double bank your time before you write anything. Think about what it is, and you can do that when you're doing anything, when you're doing the washing, making the dinner, gardening, driving to somewhere or other, picking your kids up from school. You don't have to be sitting in front of a computer to think, and that's my best hot tip.
It's exactly what I've written down. So Andre raised this earlier about maybe writing sections. So if you have your framework and you think about sections, I think that's a good way of doing things in bite-sized chunks. And you don't necessarily have to start at the beginning and end at the end. You know, you just whatever works for you as an individual, you start somewhere, just get started. And, you know, editing and polishing is, with the ability to cut and paste, is a very relatively more straightforward thing to do than it used to be. And that thing about thinking, you know, I've got walking. I mean, you're a runner, Gordon. I'm out my bike. That gets so much clarity when I don't think I'm thinking. You know, when you get that space, that's when the clarity can come. But don't lose it. Hang on to it. Get back and jot it down. You know, I think that sense of managing the time and balancing writing is to really treat yourself with kindness. Don't let it take over your life completely. It's so important that you get that good balance in your life. We all know that, but it's very easy to lose sight of it when you think there's all these pressures on you to write loads and loads of papers. So do what Andre says. Be very clear and focus on the ones that matter. Let the rest go.
And also, I think the thing is to acknowledge that loads and loads isn't necessarily good enough. It's the quality of the paper and the impact that it has that's important, rather than the quantity. Although it might feel as if quantity is important, particularly when you're setting out, it's the quality and the impact that can have on practice and the change that might make.
You're very kind to call me a runner, Anne. But I think the occasions that are, the rare occasions that I do come up with good ideas, that there's a disproportionate number of those are out when I'm running, or whether I'm when I'm walking the dog or something. It's just that sometimes the challenge is remembering those by the time you get home as well. But yes.
But now you can zip them into your phone, and
exactly.
There you go, or that old-fashioned notepad by your bedside, or whatever. You know, when you wake up in the morning with a great idea. The number of books I've got by my bedside with great ideas scribbled all over the back page is just unbelievable.
Fantastic. Again, we've kind of touched on this a bit, but I wonder if you could tell us what makes a strong manuscript, and how can authors ensure that their writing is clear and impactful?
What makes a good manuscript is something about it being logically constructed, that you can follow it, its story, if you like, and that you can understand it. I mean, some manuscripts are so full of jargon that they're just impenetrable. And don't forget, you know, you as an author might understand it, but those people who are reading it may not. So that's also something that's important, accessibility. Anne?
Clarity, readability, just reinforcing what you're saying, I think. You know, knowing your audience, and make sure you're writing for that audience. And if it's an academic journal, it might be a different audience to a weekly professional periodical. But remembering that the latter, in terms of the impact that you have and how you reach the audience you want to reach, can be the most powerful way of doing things. So that's what makes a manuscript strong. You know, knowing your stuff, knowing what you're doing, why you're doing it, knowing who you're doing it for, and not losing sight of that.
Just
and polishing. It's so important. We all know that if we read something that's well written and beautifully constructed, it gives you joy. We also know if you read something that's really, really difficult to put together, it doesn't give you a lot of joy. It's very frustrating and it's tiring. And if editors are inundated, you know, the ones that will hit the top of the pile are the ones that are a good read.
So for a writer, a little tip then to make sure it's a good read might be to print it out. Don't read it on screen. Print it out, read it, and write down beside each paragraph what the main thing is that paragraph is saying to you. And then don't look at your paragraphs, but look at your notes and see if that's logical. Because sometimes people say, well, how do you know if it's logical? And that's the sort of thing that I would do, that I'd suggest that you do. All the things that Anne says about, you know, a good manuscript, it's easy to read. It makes you feel that it's been a pleasure to do it rather than a chore.
What advice would you give to a nurse who is hesitant about writing for publication?
Anne, you want to go first?
I would probably try to explore why somebody was feeling hesitant, just trying to understand a little bit better about that, and then working through the reasons given to offer some encouragement. Do you know, it's like a loop in my head with this, because being clear about the rationale for why you want to publish, knowing who your audience is and what your messages are, I think with that clarity and that real strength, sense of purpose, it should help people get over their hesitancy, I would have thought.
I think just finding out what the hesitancy is about, you know, and then working with that person to try and help them overcome it. And sometimes that you can't overcome it either, to acknowledge that you can't and to move on from it too is probably important.
And how about the visibility and impact of the published work? How we can increase this visibility?
I think this is where social media comes in. It's that classic sense of push and pull. You can get something published, it can be online, but how do you draw people into your work? And social media is a very good vehicle for doing that. And, you know, I think there's so many different forms of social media, and it's a kind of constantly developing area. So as well as just short vignettes written and sent out through social media, there's often value in doing things like we're doing today, you know, having a full podcast or some kind of short audiovisual presentation, or including within that vignette something visual to look at. It's recognizing all the different types of social media and how to capitalize on them. But it goes back to the original point: who's your audience, and which type of social media do your audience engage in? Channeling your energies into where they're going to be most productive. That would be my advice.
Yeah, and I think on top of that, never forget the power of just talking to people, constantly chattering about your research. You know, it might get boring to you, but it probably won't be to the people that you're talking to. So talking about your research, your publications, making sure that you give papers at conferences, and you maybe take a copy of publications with you so that people can have a look at it, as well as it being available online. I think you have to use all sorts of approaches, but don't forget talking to people, because they're important too, and not everybody's on social media.
Mm. You're making me think about what was mentioned earlier. I mean, being able to convey your work in lay terms can be very difficult, but it's so important to get the message out. So that constant rehearsing of what you're doing, why you're doing it, and what you're hoping to achieve, I think it's going to really help with that whole publishing process. So, yeah, very sound advice as ever.
And thinking about that, Gordon, to add in something in terms of visibility and different audiences, were you thinking about perhaps a way that care could be delivered differently by nurses? It isn't just nurses that you need to address. It's also patients and their families and friends who will then say, I'd like care like that. So I think you need to think about visibility in different arenas. So I think the most important thing to me when I was doing my PhD was an interview on Woman's Hour. And that wasn't a journal or anything like that. But that was the most important thing to me, because it got my work to a different kind of audience. So I think very widely about who you're trying to get to again, and sort of approach people. I mean, press releases is another way of gaining visibility, and perhaps people will take those forward and interview you or ask you to do some sort of presentation or something that you'd never even thought about.
I was just about to ask Hilal how you anticipate you're going to increase visibility about your research when it's finished.
I think in the era of AI nowadays, I'm trying now to having my chatbot, which I'm training for IBE. And it's closed now for training, but I'm thinking of opening it later on. And that would be a resource for people back home and around the globe as well. So hopefully it's not only AI, we have other social platforms that I'm active in, like X, LinkedIn, Instagram. Mm-hmm. And I'm utilizing also the platforms here at GCU, which opened for us as a postgrad students.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that is certainly AI chatbots isn't something that I'm familiar with. So that's interesting to hear. Because my next
question.
Idea. I know that social media was going to be my next question, but you've answered that before I've asked it. So thank you very much. I was wondering if you could answer if there are any common myths about academic publishing that you'd like to debunk. How about reviewer two?
Everything that's published is perfect. You know, you don't have to read critically. The notion that just because it's published or it's been through peer review, so it must be correct. I think there's lots of evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think alongside writing skills, we should be saying we all need to have skills in critical appraisal, because, yeah, of course, we really value the work that peer reviewers put in, but that's only two people's perspectives on a paper, and there may be other things that really should be thought about and said from other audiences. So yeah, just because it's published doesn't mean it's good or it's been absolutely looked at from every single angle.
And of course it'd be remiss of me not to mention the RCN International Nursing Research Conference, which is an annual conference that nurses can come and present their research findings and results at. So if anyone is interested in doing that, then I strongly recommend that as a way of increasing the visibility and impact of your work.
And I'd add to that, Gordon, it offers exquisite networking opportunities.
Absolutely.
And I've witnessed over decades the number of huddles from which papers have been, you know, created, and the number of collaborations from these huddles. It is extraordinary how it connects people and creates so much good work. So I could only reinforce what you've just said in spades. Yeah. Thank you.
So this is an informal invitation of mine next time, I think.
Absolutely. No, formal invitation.
I think we have touched a little bit on handling criticism or constructive criticism from the editors. Just to elaborate more on this, how would you handle constructive criticism or even rejection, even though it's a seasoned writer?
I think it's important to never lose sight of the fact that feedback and different perspectives on what you present is to be expected. And it might take you by surprise, it might offend, it might open your eyes to different ways of seeing the world, it might make you think critically about how you write and present. There's a whole host of things, I think, to think about in terms of how you handle criticism or rejection. So learn from it, reflect on it, look for the value in different perspectives and insights. Push back when you disagree, which we've touched on earlier, but I think it's always wise to just check out your response with others before acting. It's like that angry email. Don't send it, you know, sleep on it, think about it. And where it is constructive and helpful, consider it as a real opportunity to refine and improve your work. And I would just say, don't give up. It's part of the process. Don't give up.
I think one of the most important things that I learned from constructive criticism is that if it's not clear to a reviewer or somebody who's reading it, then it's likely that it won't be clear to other people as well. So it's not the reviewer's problem. It is actually your problem. So you do need to make it clearer. Often you feel a bit resentful when people say, oh, I don't understand something. You think, oh, it's really clear. But actually, it can't be if they don't follow it. So it's, again, it's about logic and thinking through, taking a breath, stepping back is good. But I also think there's a moment where you have to move on. I think some people can take these things really to heart. And once you've thought through, you've talked about it with other people, you've put in your response, say, and maybe you get another rejection, then sometimes it's best to move on. Recast stuff, rethink about that paper, think about, does it actually have a place? Should you be waiting for more details or something like that? But the moving on is really important too. Otherwise, you can spend a long time being resentful and upset about something, whereas you could use that time positively to recraft something and maybe get something published.
Thank you. We came to our end of our today's podcast. If you could give, please, one key takeaway to first-time authors, what would it be?
There's so many, really, but I think that a polish to impress. Okay, so that sense of thinking about an editor there with the piles and piles of submissions, make your stand out. Put the work in at the front end as much as you possibly can, because it has the capacity to pay off. That's my takeaway.
My takeaway obviously is going to be something about key messages. Make sure you know what they are before you even put your pen to paper, and also restrict yourself to maybe 3 key messages rather than 30 key messages. So being absolutely crystal clear about what it is you want to say and to whom you want to say it, and make that paper as clear as you can.
Fantastic. So yes, as Helal says, we're drawing to the end of the podcast now. So I wonder if there's anything else, Andre or Anne, that you would like to add before we finish.
Not for me. Thank you for the opportunity. It's been good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been a delight to do it and to be taken back to those days of being a beginning researcher again, and how fearful it was to publish. Mm. But just to say that actually it needn't be that fearful, and that editors are not that sort of fear-inducing. Hopefully you've seen that or you've heard that today.
Absolutely. Helal, anything you would like to add?
Thank you for this opportunity to learn from such vast experience of our colleagues. Thank you very much.
Excellent. So it falls to me just to bring the podcast to a close. I'd like to thank all our listeners. And you can find more information about the podcast if you Google RCN Research Podcasts, and you'll see the other ones that we've had before now. But just to thank Andre, to thank Anne, and thank Helal, we'll just finish there. Thank you.